Yes, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Exchange. This is Cheryl Castile. My guest in the studio today, Daniel Kulik. I don't know. He'll probably cringe, but I thought it was funny because I never got to hear it as Cecil and other people referred to him. He is the master of the cool lick, and I'm sure he's heard that a million times in his life.
So much to live up to.
But he is an incredibly talented musician. He is a string man, plays all things with strings. Daniel is a musician, an educator in terms of music, produces, writes music for himself, for other people. You can see him most often in the band The Revelers, but you can also see him sitting in with a number of musicians and playing and collaborating with them, such as Yvette Landry. He had his – what was the band, D&D?
Oh, well, that was the D&D and the Mystery 3.
And the Mystery 3.
But that was more of a – they do kind of like New Moon Review, so it's three different guests.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. You had that program that you did. And then, as you can see him this Thursday, has done a lot of collaboration and work with another incredibly talented musician, Joanna Devine, and they will be at Artmosphere, actually, this Thursday evening. So you can see Daniel there. So welcome, Daniel.
Well, thank you so much, Cheryl.
Great to have you.
Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me. And, you know, you've been here before on the show, but you've always been the guy off in the side, just kind of accompanying everybody. So you make everybody else look and sound good.
Well,
I think is what it is.
You know, don't look in the shadows.
Yeah, there you go. So life started for you. I did not know this because when you had moved here, people, like I said, used to refer to you as the guy from North Carolina. But life started in Atlanta.
It's true. Yes, I'm actually fourth generation Georgian, multiple generations Georgian, but
yeah.
Fourth generation Atlantan.
So how did music come into your life?
I'm not really sure. You know, the most I can really think back to that was, and you might laugh, but watching Looney Tunes cartoons.
Yeah.
And kind of old movies. Or not even old movies, but I remember some of the first hearing jazz for the first time was probably through cartoons, and also through certain movies too. And I would listen, or like finding out later on, like, oh, that's a Hokie Carmichael tune, or that's a Jerome Kern tune, or I would hear these songs that in movies or kind of cartoons that I watched as a kid.
Cartoons had great like soundtracks that
went
along
did,
with
yeah.
them.
Oh, they did, yeah, for sure.
I mean, music was an integral part of what the emotion was at that time of the character,
yeah,
you know, what was happening.
For sure. So I kind of feel like that was the first thing. And then I remember having like Motown cassettes as a kid and like the Four Tops and sort of stuff like that. And I was kind of way into I remember this later kind of listening to my mom's. She had some Wilson Pickett records and stuff. Mm. But they didn't listen to music around the house and we never saw any music.
Yeah.
Ever.
Interesting, yeah.
But I was just, you know, way into it. And so eventually started playing guitar maybe around 10 or so, but put it down.
That was the first instrument, mm-hmm. guitar. Okay.
But I didn't pick it. I never really went very far. And
Did you actually have one? Or
I did,
just
yeah.
Go, okay.
I had one and I had an acoustic guitar. And then I played for maybe a year or two and took some lessons and didn't really do any more and kind of put it down for 3 years or so. And then I was listening to a lot of bluegrass and picked up the mandolin.
And how did you start listening to a lot of bluegrass? Where'd you start hearing it?
Kind of, I was into kind of like 60s rock and roll stuff. And then they would always have their acoustic record or their bluegrass record or something. So like the Grateful Dead or Heaven Olden in the Way.
So you were going to a music store to get the stuff? You had some stations where you grew up that you could pick it up on?
Not really. I just read a lot, I guess.
Okay, yeah.
And, I mean, I had some sort of kind of like hippie friends or had older brothers or sisters or something that would probably
okay. –
that probably gave me some stuff, you know. Or actually, I did – I had a history teacher when I was in
– Is this about the mandolin?
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you bring – because then I won't bring it up. I'm glad you're bringing that up. That's so great.
Yeah,
keep
going. I did have – so I had this history teacher when I was 15, and I was kind of already listening. I had a mandolin, but I wasn't kind of playing it that much. And then he kind of gave me some – his name was Alan Barksdale, and he's actually still teaching in Atlanta at the same school. But this was his first year teaching at this school too.
Mm.
So I'm sure he was like, oh, this is going to be great. You have these kids that are into this weird, obscure music. So he was giving me kind of old-time tapes of like bands like Gid Tarin and Skillet Liquors and the Tobacco Tags and Earl Johnson and his Clodhoppers and Riley Puckett, kind of all these Georgia string bands that recorded in Georgia in the late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah.
So right at the beginning of the 78 period. And – so he was giving me all those cassettes as well as Bill Monroe stuff and Stanley Brothers and Flat and Scruggs. And so I was kind of listening to all that stuff and getting into bluegrass through him. And then at the same time, listening to kind of Thelonious Monk and Charles Mingus. And I was kind of into like all this other jazz stuff too.
Yeah.
So I felt like it because I'd maybe played a string instrument before, I bought a mandolin because I figured – I kind of know this, whereas I didn't pick up a horn or something because I just didn't have that knowledge, whereas maybe, you know, in another year I could have bought a horn or something, but I wound up playing that.
So you wrote a paper in high school on the history of the mandolin.
I did.
Which, you know, which I find interesting. If you'd like, you can read that online.
Oh, God.
You can write – I mean, I don't think there's a lot of people where you can read – a paper they wrote in high school online.
Yeah, well.
But it's good.
I'm happy that somebody likes it.
Yeah. I mean, when that came up, I was like, what the heck? It's a history. It's a high school history paper. That was wonderful.
I got to take off my coat now.
It's getting hot in here. But how did he – did he ask you to write that? Or you had to pick a subject? Do you remember doing it?
I kind of do. It was – geez. This was – this was quite some time ago, but it was actually a senior. It was like a senior writing class, and so it was pick whatever topic and learn, you know, kind of get better at writing something. So I was sort of ate up with playing music, and so I was like, "Well, I'll just do this. This will be kind of semi interesting."
Yeah. And now it's for everybody to see.
And now it's for everybody to see from here till Christmas.
Yeah, I have a question because you talked about, you know, at that time you were listening like to Thelonious Monk. You were really paying attention to jazz. You had really been listening to bluegrass. And so, you know, there's a part too that I don't know if somebody had talked to you about it in an interview or just it listed you as playing focused on jazz mandolin. I mean, excuse my ignorance on that, but is mandolin is that used in some jazz stuff?
I mean, not so much. There's kind of this – there's like this offshoot of traditional bluegrass where it's the new acoustic music and people like Daryl Anger and David Grisman and Matt Glazer and sort of these people that kind of play acoustic-y swing sort of stuff.
Okay.
And so there's an offshoot of that includes mandolin. And then there's – Western swing, which has electric mandolin.
Yeah.
So those are kind of the two ones, but I never really – I mean, I played in a swing band playing acoustic and electric mandolin. And to me – and if I do pick up the mandolin these days, I usually play this electric one that's – it only has four strings and it's tuned down. So it kind of sounds more like an archtop guitar. And to me – the timbre of that fits better with playing with drums and or stuff like it kind of fits better like that. Whereas the acoustic mandolin, I never really – the idea of that with drums and everything else kind of never – just the sound just never really worked for me.
Yeah. When you were in high school and really started focusing on playing, did you play in bands at that time?
Not so much. I would sit in with a lot of bands.
Okay.
I was very eager.
Yeah.
I had hair halfway down my back and was just, you know, was just playing as much as I could and everywhere. I would drive to sit in with friends of mine. I had a lot of friends that were older than me, so I was 17, and they were in their late 20s, early 30s, and playing in bars in Atlanta.
What was the music scene like in Atlanta at that time when you were that age?
It was actually, I mean, to me it was really cool. It was sort of at the – I remember right around the time – and I had a lot of friends that were, I mean, I guess professional musicians.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of under them so I could get into places.
Sure, sure, yeah.
And so actually near where my parents lived or still live in Atlanta, there was a bar called the Brandy House. And I believe you had to be 18 to get in there, and I was probably 16 or 17. But I would go, and Colonel Bruce Hampton, who's kind of a legendary Atlanta kind of hippie rock – or not really hippie, just kind of weirdo rock and roll kind of guy. But he had month stints at this place. He had just kind of – so he would play there for 6 months every Friday and Saturday. So I would go. And he would – and the whole thing was – it was – Colonel Bruce Hampton, it used to be the Aquarium Rescue Unit, and then it moved into another band, and this one was called, like, Planet Zambi, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
And the whole thing was he would have special guests every week. So it was whoever was in town, and sometimes it would be, I mean, I can't remember, I mean, honestly. I mean, it would be like Ronnie McCurry and the Del McCurry Band showed up one time, or...
That's the son. Ronnie's the one
that plays the mandolin. Yeah. So it's like they would show up, and then maybe the next week would be... what's his face that plays the slide guitar with Derek Trucks.
Oh, okay.
You know, all the I mean it
so
was just
all kinds of music.
Yeah, it was just so random whoever was happened to be playing in Atlanta, because they all love Colonel Bruce.
Mm.
And so he'd say, "Oh, why don't you come sit in late night?"
Yeah, yeah.
So it was kind of going through, I felt like, a renaissance. Maybe I was 17 too, so maybe it just seemed like it was just...
But a good education time for being able to watch all those.
It was great, yeah.
Did you ever get to get up and play at that place?
No. I never played with them. I used to play and sit in with this band with a banjo player that used to play with Bruce, or was in actually the first incarnation of the Aquarium Rescue Unit. And I would play with, they were called... Blueground Undergrass, and they used to tour and stuff. They were kind of – but they were from Atlanta, and I would sit in with them. I sat in with them a couple times, and with them with Vassar Clements one time I sat in, which was – I was 17, 18 or something. And another time – random times, and then – yeah.
Very, very cool, though.
I mean, it was fun.
That was a good time for you.
It was great. I mean, you know, I was able to – kind of learn a lot from different aspects of it. I mean, everything from just getting your sound in the monitor to, you know, dealing with, I don't know, just seeing how people relate backstage.
Sure.
Seeing how people just kill time.
Yeah. Did you ever take music lessons at all, Dan, or is it all self-taught for you?
Just when I was I took guitar lessons when I was a kid probably – maybe a year at the most, and then I put it down. So, and then I've taken a handful of lessons from people I've liked. I took a mandolin lesson from Mike Compton, who plays with I don't know anymore. He used to play with John Hartford.
Okay.
And so I took one. I really liked how he played, so I went to his house in Nashville, and he wound up not charging me because we were kind of friends.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's now playing with – he's. I mean, since he was kind of on that Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack, so he was able to –
sure.
He kind of – I think I've – he was in Elvis Costello. He did that last Elvis Costello record when he kind of did a bluegrass band. And then I took another lesson from Andy Statman in Brooklyn when I turned 21, which was just another person that I liked. But those are the only two I've ever kind of had.
So at that age, was a lot of your free time spent just – playing? I mean, just yourself sitting in a room figuring things out?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And it still is.
Yeah, and it still is, which is good.
Yeah.
You brought in probably about 5 or 6 songs.
Mm-hmm.
But the first one that you brought in, you said, was kind of from some of your earlier days, called New Minor.
Right.
And it's a swing band that that you were playing in?
It was kind of a Django Reinhardt.
Where were you living at this point?
In Asheville, North Carolina.
Okay. How'd you end up over there?
I moved to Asheville to go to college, supposedly. But kind of Asheville had a burgeoning – this was in 1999, and it had a burgeoning sort of acoustic music scene. And kind of playing – I mean, there was some sort of stuff like kind of progressive – or not progressive, but I don't know. Kind of bluegrass and old-time music and some jazz and some stuff. So, and there was a lot of young people living there. The cheap rent was cheap. It was beautiful. It was – it kind of wasn't – it was still somewhat hidden.
Yeah.
It kind of wasn't.
Before it got on all the lists.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely it wasn't the retirement mecca that it is now.
Sure.
And, I mean, I remember my friends had a 5-bedroom house, and they each paid $150.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and even then you sit there and think about it, like $700 for a 5-bedroom house or something.
That's right.
It was just – so it was – there was a lot of young people there that were playing this music. Yeah, and then we were all into similar stuff in the culture – we were all kind of probably from the South, and we were all kind of going to a place where it felt like there were still older people too that were playing this music there. And so that's when I moved there and lived there for 8 or 9 years until it shifted.
Did you have a specific focus at that time in terms of what style of music you were playing?
No, I was pretty lost and just
– Yeah, just whatever.
Well, yeah, and I was kind of pretty eager to like – I was kind of wrapped up in like, I have to be doing this and I have to be very – I hadn't quite yet learned to let that go and it didn't really matter.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I was pretty – I don't know if arrogance is the word, but just like I don't know. My mind was set on something.
Yeah. But that's all part of the life process.
It is, yeah.
You know? And we can look back to those
for
times.
Sure.
And
for sure.
So this band – was there a name to the band at that time?
Yeah, it still exists, actually. The band's called One Leg Up.
Okay.
And it was kind of a Django Reinhardt-type swing band, and we started playing. I had some friends that – it was a guitar player who sort of started it with another guitar player, and I knew him from playing bluegrass, and he knew that I was sort of into that stuff, and they had a local gig at a French creperie in Asheville that was open – for about two years, and we played there every Saturday night for about a year and a half, which is kind of how the band started and sort of congealed in members. And
were you playing mandolin or playing fiddle? Okay.
I played mandolin. I didn't play fiddle back then.
Okay.
And I played mandolin, and if one of the guitar players was there, I'd play guitar and sort of sub out. So, and then, yeah, they still exist. I guess it's probably been, geez, I mean, that record, that's the second record that this song is from, so... it's probably almost been 10 years they've been together.
Okay.
Probably, right. Yeah.
Well, let's listen to This Is New Minor. Thank you. was New Minor. What was the name of the band?
The One Leg Up, and they still exist.
If you're ever in, exist.
If you're ever in Asheville, North Carolina, you can see them at a probably cocktail lounge near you.
There you go. And if you're just joining us, this is The Exchange. My guest today is musician, amongst many other things that he does, Daniel Kulik. I'm curious now. You were playing mandolin. When did you play fiddle before you moved here?
I sort of messed around, not really very much. I mean, I maybe bought a fiddle when I was 24 and then would pick it up for a week or two here or there. But yeah. I never focused on it probably until I moved here and people started hiring me to play fiddle. And I was like, oh, my God, I need to kind of learn how to play this.
Yeah, see, that's the way you do it. You get hired first and then you figure out what the heck, you know, what do I have to do?
I guess so.
So how'd you end up here?
I'd been living in Asheville playing a lot of wedding, maybe making a living playing music, but it was playing a lot of jazz and sort of swing music like that. And I knew the people in the Red Stick Ramblers from going to fiddlers conventions and stuff.
Were you teaching back then, or were you going?
No.
Oh yeah, fiddlers convention. You were playing.
Yeah,
fiddle, yeah.
And so, but you just kind of go to these kind of campouts.
That's right.
Yeah, like Mount Airy Fiddlers Convention,
yeah.
Cliff Top, and
yeah.
stuff like that, and Galax, and they had started going to those after Kevin joined the band.
Yeah.
After Kevin Wimmer joined the band, and Kevin Wimmer used to visit in Asheville because he had friends up there from the old time scene because he was into that. So there's kind of like worlds colliding
sure,
a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And my friends would come down here to Louisiana.
Which that world is very – I mean, there's a lot of players, but that world is very small.
It's
though,
true.
In terms of people knowing each other and hooking up. And
for sure. You know, because a lot of times you teach at the same camps.
Yeah.
You'd like – and so – and like Dirk used to play old-time music a lot.
Sure.
So Dirk knew a lot of the same people in Asheville because Asheville's a small hub of the four – of the maybe seven hubs of old-time music in the country.
Okay.
It was a big hub. So they started coming to fiddlers conventions and then they knew my friends and we would camp near each other. So we kind of mutually became friends and would be playing, you know, swing music or old time music or rags or whatever at fiddlers conventions. And then I started coming down to Louisiana to visit. And after, I think I came down for a month or something one time after Black Pot. It was the second or third Black Pot. And I stayed for about a month and I wound up playing a couple gigs somehow. I was staying with Chaz when Chaz Justice, the guitar player for the Red Sticks and the Revelers, and I was living with him or staying with him out in Eunice, and he didn't want to drive to town one day to play a gig with Blake Miller and Cedric Watson. And he was like, well, you just go play it. It was a little private gig playing guitar. And so I was like, yeah, sure, I'll go.
Yeah.
So I wound up doing that. And then after that, Cedric started calling me to go play gigs. So
That's okay.
Yeah, it was kind of one of the, and I wasn't even living here.
Yeah.
You know, so. And we wound up playing a couple kind of honky tonk sort of gigs at the Blue Moon. And
what were you playing? You were playing guitar?
Probably guitar and electric mandolin.
Okay. Acoustic guitar? Or
electric,
do you play electric guitar?
Yeah, I was probably playing telly.
With him. Okay. All right. Is that, acoustic guitar came into your life first, though?
Well, yeah. They were the cheap, I mean, it was like you didn't have to have an amp.
Yeah, yeah. And then, but electric guitar is something you started playing quite young?
Well, yeah, I think I did have an electric guitar. I had one of the first people that showed me anything guitar was a friend of the family, as it usually is for people. And he had a, like a Flying X type guitar.
Yeah.
And so I still haven't. I've been meaning to bring it back.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I had that and some tiny little amp that he gave me. And I could play the Pretty Woman riff.
All
and
right.
Day Tripper.
There you go. Good for you. You should have brought that today.
I know.
Today would have been the day to pull it out, Daniel.
I know. I probably would have messed it up, though.
Yeah. So, all right. So you started playing with Cedric.
I did.
And then thought, well, I might as well move.
Well, I mean, we played a couple. I probably played one gig or two. And he was – and then he was – I remember he called me maybe. And I was like, well, I don't really live there. And he was like, oh, okay. Well, and, you know, it was November, and I went back to Asheville, and it was – I mean, it's in the Appalachians. Granted, it's not super high, but it's high enough that it was below freezing when I got back there.
Yeah.
And I was – I kind of went, and I used to play at sort of these fancy hotels and stuff, and I remember getting back from one of the gigs and looking at all my stuff in my apartment. And I was like, I don't even own any of this. I was like, none of this is mine. I didn't pay for it.
Yeah.
It's the people that own the house, or I lived in this garage apartment, or it was just given to me. And so I was like, I can just pack up and leave.
Yeah.
So I called up Chaz the next day and I said, I was like, hey, I'm thinking about moving. And he was like, well, I got a room for you. And I left a week later.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah. So it's kind of spur of the moment. And no, I didn't. I didn't really have very many gigs when I first moved here. But yeah, I started. It was kind of at a time where Cedric had kind of just started the Bijou Creole. And,
sure.
And Blake Miller and Chris Stafford were both still in college at the time. And I was not.
Yeah.
So all the long tours, I kind of wound up either playing bass or electric guitar.
Yeah, you got to go do them.
Yeah, which was great. And yeah. It was, you know, I'd never left the country before I started playing with Cedric. That was the first time.
When you started touring with him, in terms of the style of music that Cedric was playing, did that feel comfortable right away for you?
I mean, I had kind of been playing various like French music
when
I was coming down here, or with the Red Sticks, like up it and listening to it and stuff. So,
sure.
I mean, it was pretty. I felt pretty. Maybe after a week or so, after that, it was. I mean, I'd listened to it a lot for a number of years.
Yeah.
So I felt pretty comfortable, I think.
Who was the first band you played fiddle with when you had to learn?
I think Cedric, actually. I think the first gig I actually ever played with him, we played a Mardi Gras dance, or like a float, like a parade in Youngsville. It was maybe, you know, the Saturday before or something, whenever they had their parade. And he called – I'll never forget. He called me up and he's like, I want you to come play fiddle with me. And I was like, okay. He goes, yeah, Chris isn't going to be there, so I want you to come play fiddle. And I was like, well, I can play guitar. And he was like, no, it'll be cool. I want you to play fiddle. And I was like, I remember calling up Blake Miller, who's playing bass with him, and I was like, he wants me to play fiddle. I'm like, he was like, yeah, it'll be great, man. It'll be really cool. And so I was just like, okay. So I think that was the first time.
Yeah, I mean, you must have pulled it off.
I guess, you know. Smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, yeah. Is for you to pick up, because what I've heard a lot of people that talk about you, Daniel, is, you know, you'll hear, you're a talked about musician, and, you know, you'll hear that phrase that a lot of people use, that, you know, yeah, he's scary good, you know. Have you ever noticed it for yourself that there, is there much of a learning curve for you, or is it boom? I tend to learn pretty quickly on.
I don't know. I feel like. I guess, I don't know, to me, I guess it's more of a, I don't know how good or how much talent, I don't really know what that means.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and I'm not trying to be, I'm kind of honest.
Yeah,
Because I've hung around a lot of musicians, and some people have really great ears.
Yeah.
Some people have really quick fingers. Some people have, I think if there's one talent that I have, I think the only thing is just that I kind of, when I first started playing, and it still happens, if I was trying to learn something or do something and I couldn't do it, I kind of, like, I had to do it. It was sort of like this anxiety that would develop. Kind of, I don't know if it's obsessive compulsive disorder or what it is, but I mean, when I first started playing, like, I would stay up till 3 a.m. until I learned that tune or I could play it in a tempo or... Same. I mean, I used to paint and draw and stuff. And it was the same
thing.
Oh,
you did?
Yeah, and I used to stay up until I finished or was to a point where it was finishable or something,
sure,
you know.
Sure.
And so, and to the same thing where I don't really play music at night or work on stuff at night because I'll stay up all night.
But you've had to kind of train yourself to not do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
that must not have been easy.
Well, no. But, I mean, there's also fun stuff you can do. Like, I used to come back from the bar and when I was living in Asheville and at that garage apartment, and I would, like, put on James Brown and just pick up the guitar and have a little buzz and maybe play the bass line of the, you know, kind of go through the record.
Sure.
And play the bass line for every tune, or then figure out the horn parts or figure out kind of stuff, like, which is kind of fun, and it's not like learning something and being all –
yeah.
Serious about it.
It sounds like, listening to you talk, you've been able to find a bit of a balance for you that that keeps playing fun? I mean, I know it's work yeah. also, but
I mean, I love playing. I love practicing.
Yeah.
I love
You do. Okay.
I love to me it's not really it's like exercise or it's like you can I don't know. I look at it like sort of in this might but you look at sort of let's say I want to learn this tune
sure.
or I want to work on this and there's a way you can look at that and say you can use that as a small if I can have the patience to get through this then maybe I can have the patience to you know stand in line and not get upset or listen to you know somebody go on about a story and have the patience to listen to them and have you know I mean
very good.
I mean that's kind of like a macro way to think about it and that's
yeah.
kind of how I look at it like practicing music is not the end all be all it's a larger scope of practicing for your life.
Of how you live.
Yeah. And granted, you know, you can talk to my girlfriend who I live with and she'll probably say I'm full of something.
Well, let's pull her in. She's right outside the door. No, I'm kidding.
God.
No, I'm kidding.
I was kind of nervous. I thought she might have been.
You know, I'm curious. Do you, you know, so finding out that you paint, do you visualize music?
Oh, I haven't painted in a long time.
But,
no.
But you don't visualize music.
Well.
Do you see it up here? I'm always curious about that.
Not so much. I see I listen to a lot of music based on like how the recording sounds,
okay.
like sort of in a sonic way, like, you know, and I find myself listening to stuff because I want to hear how that particular record sounds
yeah.
or something. And sometimes, I mean, there's certain records where I'm like, I can say, well, it feels like I'm floating or it feels like there's certain records that just have a certain airy quality or something, but or sort of grounded quality, but I don't know if I really see it in a scenic way.
Okay. You brought in another song, Birdcage,
mm-hmm.
and I should mention this is a part of a score that you worked on for an original score for musical theater.
That's
was The Dream
true.
Of the Marionettes.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean, you also have that on your resume.
It was more of Joanna Devine who – I guess I co-wrote most of that stuff with who – or she wrote a couple of more tunes who I would say probably she has a 70 to my 30% ownership of that.
Yeah.
But, she was just writing it and we were friends. We played in another little country band in town. And we – I went over there one night and she was working on something and I kind of helped her out with – I was like, well, maybe you could voice it like this or try this. And then she was like, well, you want to write some? I said, yeah. And so we started writing a lot together and – it was really – we worked well.
And now this cut you brought in was not from the show, but it's one that was recorded on one of her CDs.
Right.
Okay. This is Birdcage.
Used to be colors all look the same, but these days they've changed. Things were always black or white. Time was always day or night. But I never could figure wrong from right. Never saw a bright sunrise. Never met my lover's eyes. Never knew the heartache of a last goodbye. That's not for me. No pain, no misery. From see those silly much I see your game. That running around is such a shame. Up here the sun is shining, but for you there's only rain.
That was Joanna Devine, and also, let's see, that was Kevin Wimmer, you said, on fiddle.
I believe David Egan on piano, and Eric Fry probably on bass, and Glenn Fields on drums.
And you?
No, I was not playing
on that.
Oh,
you didn't play on that. You just helped to compose it.
Yep.
All
which
right.
is fine with me. She did a great job.
If you're just joining us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at krvs.org. We are a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette here at Cypress Lake Studios. And we are listener supported. So thanks to all of you who help us continue to air all the different programs that we have here. You can always donate. Go to the website. It's very easy. Press the donate button. It's a safe, secure site. So thanks, and please continue to do that for us here. My guest in the studio, musician, composer for not only songs used in bands, but songs used in musical theater, writer, all around self-actualized man, Daniel Kulik.
Trying every day.
And as I said at the beginning of the show, you can see Daniel mostly, most often, I guess. I don't think mostly is a word. Most often with the band The Revelers. But you can see him this Thursday with Joanna Devine, who you just heard. They'll be at Artmosphere. And then he hits the road again. Daniel, I'm curious, were you writing – was that a focus of your musical career prior to moving here?
I wrote a little bit, maybe tunes, not really. I wrote a couple songs, never really played them with any bands or anything.
Yeah.
It was always writing's, it was always a lot easier for me to sit down and learn tunes or solos or stuff like that than it was to really write songs.
Yeah.
It was always kind of a harrowing sort of process.
Yeah. Is it something that's become more enjoyable for you at all?
Sometimes I feel like it's just not as cut and dry as learning something. It's a much more involved process. And writing tunes, instrumental music, is a lot easier. And I feel like it's more plug and play. But writing lyrics is a little more, I don't know, it's a little more daunting. But I find like if you at least have an idea and a storyline, then it's become easier the more songs that I've written.
Sure.
And the more that I've worked with people,
yeah,
like Joanna, or I've written a number of songs with Kelly Jones, Savoy, and actually Glenn Fields and I have written a couple songs now together. And
how does that come about for you? I mean, how does that process occur? Like, let's say with Kelly. How did
– well, Kelly's a great songwriter as well. And we – I don't know. It was a couple of years ago, and I had – usually I usually can string about a chorus together or a verse. And I'm like, oh, that would be a good story. That's a good sort of something. And sometimes I can figure out where to go from there, and other times I can't. And at this particular point, I couldn't figure out where to go. And Kelly and I were hanging out, maybe run into each other, and I was like, hey, you're going to be in town? Well, let's get together and maybe, like, I'll show you this song and see if you have any ideas.
Okay.
And so she just sort of – she was like, yeah, I like that. And so found a key for her to sing it in because I'm a not very good singer. And then we kind of just sort of figured it out. It's usually – I don't know. It's usually like this – I'm a lot better. I like working with somebody because it lets them sort of sing and kind of be – let the melody go where they go, and then I can sort of put some chords underneath it, and then we can kind of go in places together.
Yeah, yeah. You like to arrange.
I like to arrange, and I like working with people. I like getting out of my own story in my head and hearing where somebody else thinks the story might go, or just seeing the form that you maybe set up. Like, I had a song – that I've been working on, and I had a bridge, but I didn't have the whole story. And I was over at Joanna's rehearsing a couple months ago, and I showed it to her, and she was like, oh, well, your next verse should be this.
Hmm.
And I was like, that's right. That's exactly what it should be.
Yeah, that's nice when you find that, huh? When you find people like that, that it's
for
very
sure.
comfortable to,
yeah.
to go back and forth.
And, you know, and you have to somewhat detach yourself from – I feel like these things, like I don't think you can hold on to your idea of, well, this is my song and my song's going this way.
Yeah, yeah.
You kind of just have to go, it's a song and let's just get it done.
Yeah.
And like move on to the next one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, you can't really, it's hard. I found that whenever I've tried to write a certain song, it doesn't really work.
Yeah. Well, let's make sure we get a couple of these in.
Yeah, that'd be great.
You talking about it. So this one, you brought one in that you and Kelly Jones, Savoie, that you were mm-hmm. just talking about, Sweet Inspiration.
Oh, no, that's a Dan.
I'm on the wrong
yeah,
one.
Yeah, Kelly and I wrote song Cry For You.
Oh,
that was actually the first one that I wrote.
I misread my arrows.
Oh.
Okay, so Cry For You is the one that you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Tell me how that one came about.
Well, it's kind of an embarrassing story, but I'll go. So –
You don't have to tell the whole thing.
Well,
Daniel.
I like to tell the truth.
Yeah.
So, actually, Chaz, myself, and Eric Fry, Chaz Justice, myself, and Eric, we were one of the first Red Stick Rambler gigs I ever played before I was actually in the band. I was filling in.
Chaz is one of those people, though, that you can just say, kind of like Cher.
Yeah.
You don't have to say the whole name.
Well, yeah, that's true. So, we were at a wedding, and I was being somewhat cynical about, not about the couple getting married because they're beautiful. Great
yeah.
people, but the scene that was there and the place it was, and I'm not going to go into details.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think, I don't know, we were just kind of saying something and something about, I was like, man, and all these people crying and we were kind of making fun and stuff. And he was just like, he kind of was like, are you heartless or something? He kind of had this thing.
Yeah.
And so I sort of had this idea of like, now you say that I don't cry or something. It just had this sort of – and it wasn't really in response to him, but it just kind of made me think about – oftentimes when I write songs, I like to write songs from perspectives that are outside of my own actual
yeah.
experience. But like watching movies and seeing like – you know, you – like writing stories, you get into different perspectives of stuff. And so this was from the perspective of some jilted lover or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
And this is Kelly singing?
This is actually Glenfield. This is the Reveler recording.
Oh, for Cry For You.
Yeah.
Well, wait, what did I screw up? So what one did you and Kelly write?
We wrote this one together.
Cry For You.
Yeah, I wrote the first. I wrote like sort of the chorus, and then Kelly and I got together, and she kind of helped me write the verses.
Got it.
Or she helped. Yes, we wrote the verses together.
All right. Well, let's listen to Cry For You.
Okay.
Showered you in pearls, but you wanted diamond rings. Let you drink the finest wine, you wanted glasses of champagne. Had you opened your eyes, you'd find
no use in holding on to love that was never meant to be. I found there's nothing in this world that you really want from me. Had you opened your eyes, you'd find these eyes have cried for you. Now you say that I don't cry, but you see that I have eyes. These eyes have cried for you. Now you can look in all directions, try and find another who you think would cry for you. Who you think would cry for you.
All right, so as not to confuse you, as I did earlier, that was Cry For You, and that was the Revelers. That was Glenn Fields singing, but Kelly Jones did help write that song.
Correct.
All right. As did my guest, Daniel Kulik. Daniel, we're talking about your process of writing and arranging and creating. I do want to mention the other thing that is on your resume.
I have another thing?
Yeah.
Really?
Is now has been featured as musician, you know, go figure that.
Go figure.
As a bit part on the show Tremé, which is an HBO series
that's
filmed
right
down in New Orleans.
It was filmed.
Was filmed.
That's right.
That's right. It's in the last. So how
– It's over.
How was that experience for you?
It was great. Came at a great time. Wintertime. Didn't really have a lot of gigs.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Did you learn anything from it, or was it, or did it?
That the film industry is even more hurry up and wait than playing music.
Ah, okay.
And that musicians and festival promoters actually have their stuff way more together than production companies.
Interesting.
Yeah.
In terms of the organization of a project?
Oh, I remember, yeah, one of the first or couple times we went down there to do something, they changed the time on us a couple times. And I remember Glenn Fields. And he was sitting there going like – he was like, it's like they don't even have their stuff together. He's like, what's going on here? Yeah. I mean, come on. And yeah. I remember just sitting there going, I was like, I don't really care. What am I going to do all day? And,
yeah.
And he was like, you know, it's like they wouldn't change our set. It's like, you know, festival has their set times and you're here and you load in and you do your thing. And it was pretty amazing how, you know, speaking to friends of ours that are on production, they're just like, and they just say that's how it is.
Mm-hmm. That's how it works.
Yeah, so – That,
but
you know,
a cool experience. That
was great. Yeah, yeah. I can't. I mean, I can sort of act like it wasn't. But no, it was great. And, you know, I'm happy to. It was a great experience. And, you know, waiting for the next one, whatever that experience will be.
Yeah, yeah. What would you like to do next musically? What are some things that you haven't, that you would like to see yourself doing musically?
Well, I'd like to kind of get into just kind of recording more and getting more of my stuff, or not really my stuff, but just experimenting more and maybe having more, especially like, let's say, getting ready for this show. It would have been great if I had the 20 tunes that I've written or done or just experimented with and said, oh, which ones of these can I choose instead of going, well, I've got this thing from this record. Like that last song, it was great. I love how the Revelers play it. Yet it'd be fun to record it in a different way and have, you know, and hear it in a different groove or a different singer or a different arrangement or something.
Yeah.
There's so many, you know, possibilities and I'd like to – and just sounds of recordings. I like I was saying earlier, I like sounds of recordings a lot, and I'd like to hear – experiment with sounds the way that I'd like – perceive them or at least try to attain to get those sounds, whereas the engineers that I work with, you know, they don't want to have me go, well, let me move the mic here and try like it shouldn't have to be my experimentation time, shouldn't have to be on their time, I guess.
Sure.
So I'd like to experiment more with that. I don't know. I love playing tunes. I just like to play tunes.
Yeah. I mean, that's who you are.
Yeah.
Are there certain people that you would like to like, are there other singers out there that you would like to hear do some stuff that you write?
Oh.
Are there certain people's voices that, gosh, I would really like to hear them on?
Maybe. I've never really thought like that, honestly. You know, I mean, we've collaborated with various people. I'd like to hear – I mean, yeah, possibly. I mean, we did a I guess it was a couple of – the summer I joined the Red Stick Ramblers, I got to see what a Red Stick Rambler summer was.
Mm, yeah.
And we had done the first – they helped me get hired to teach at my first camp, which was at Ashokan.
What did you teach?
Jazz mandolin, maybe, or mandolin 1 and 2.
That must have been where I saw that jazz mandolin. Okay,
it probably was, and I also led the mandolin orchestra.
Hmm.
So, and it was for the Western Swing Week camp at.
Do you enjoy teaching?
I do. Yeah. Is for the most part. No, I do like teaching.
Yeah.
It's fun. I mean, it's if they can get me to answer the correct question that they're looking for.
Yeah.
I mean, especially when you can help somebody out and show them. I like to help people learn to enjoy playing music and to do it in a relaxed way.
Yeah.
That to me is what I like helping people do.
Yeah.
You know, and not like in a, well, we're going to breathe and we're going to, but just to enjoy, just to go like, wow, I get to learn this tune today. That'll be fun.
That's right.
That's something I want to do. And if you don't want to do it, that's okay too. But to do it because you want to do it and because it's fun.
And do it in your own way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And to, you know, and to not get caught up on the, well, this is the correct way to do this and this is the correct way to do this. I mean, to learn it, you know, the best that you can.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, you guys are going to be head out on the road again?
Oh, we're just going for a weekend.
Okay.
We have like a weekend in January, a weekend in February, Mardi Gras stuff with the Revelers, and then we're going to Scotland and Ireland.
Oh, very nice.
In March for about 3 weeks.
Very nice.
So,
have you been before to either of those two places?
You know, I've never been over there.
Very good.
So I'm hoping it will be dreary and cold in March.
Yeah. Go to Ireland. Tony can lay out the schedule for
you. That's right. Yeah. Well, I think we have 2 days off in that entire 3 weeks. So.
Yeah.
But that'll be fun. But what I was going to say is the first summer, right after Ashokan, our friends Ruth Unger, who's Jay Unger's daughter, and her husband Mikey, who has a recording studio, and they have a duo called Mike and Ruthie. And I guess a number of years before that, the Red Sticks had recorded a song with her, and she's a great singer and fiddle player. And so we were kind of, Glenn and I had been listening to a lot of Dan Penn and Spooner Oldham, who are songwriters that we really like from Muscle Shoals. And she had been listening to some of the songs that they had written, but not necessarily them. And so we got together and recorded in Mikey's house and did this song called Sweet Inspiration, which is, I don't know, kind of, I really like. They're songwriters that I really look up to in their sort of simplicity and just staying to the subject of the songs they're writing.
Okay. Well, Daniel Kulik, thank you for coming today.
Oh, thank you, Cheryl.
We're going to go out listening to Sweet Inspiration. Have a good week, everyone.
Please.
1, 2, 3, 4. I need your sweet. Every hour of the day, without your sweet.
KRVS underwriting announcements reach listeners with your message of support and information about your business or event. To find out more about partnering with South Louisiana's Regional Public Radio Program Source, call us at 482-5787. 482-KRVS.
I'm Poppy Tooker, host of Louisiana Eats. Tune in Saturday afternoons at 4 p.m. for your weekly serving on KRVS 88.7 FM, listener-supported public radio for Acadiana.
From the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, this is KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.